At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We start today with climate change for fun and profit. We take a detour to Italy. That one is mostly profit. And we finish with television of the future. From American Public Media on the radio, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, the 24th of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. The conferences and the meetings and the general assemblies continued in New York City today. And one of the big through lines, not the geopolitical through line, but the geoeconomic through line, if you will, has been climate change. Those 300,000 marchers over the weekend, President Obama and more than 100 heads of state at the United Nations pushing for a low-carbon future, public events up and down Manhattan. But come on, be honest. Raise your hand if you have climate fatigue. It's all right. The parts per billion, the Arctic shelf, the guilt. Well, business types in New York are trying to change the way we talk about climate, make it less about selflessness and altruism and more about investments and markets and profits. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
You may have asked yourself, what can I do on climate change? Bike to work, eat local?
When people ask me that question, and they do, my response is always the same.
That's Harvard's Rob Stavins, an environmental economist. Now, be prepared, his answer stings.
What you will be able to accomplish or contribute through your solo actions is so small it is lost in the noise.
Ouch. See, the problem is too big. Stavins says you need scale, preferably for the lowest possible cost, environmental bang for your buck. And one big bang is coal pollution. That's 44% of world emissions right there. Cleaner alternatives are solar and wind and natural gas. Helge Lund is president and CEO of Statoil, the Norwegian energy giant.
One of the most important opportunities for reducing CO2 emissions is actually to make sure that gas is replacing coal in the electricity generation.
Some replacement is already happening, but in order to speed it up,
you have to have a significantly higher CO2 price.
A CO2 price is the buck part. Here's the idea. Fossil fuels pollute, so policymakers can take that environmental cost and add it into the price of fossil energy, that is, raise the price. And that makes low-carbon technology more competitive. Now, which ones would deploy? Natural gas, LED lights, solar, coal plants that bury emissions under the ground? Stavins says governments don't have to pick. Investors and customers will.
That's the virtue of a carbon pricing mechanism. It will automatically draw to the fore those technologies, those practices, which are lowest cost.
For instance, if solar is the cheapest, the best option for household power, consumers will pick that. Solar panel seller IKEA thinks they will. Here's President and CEO Peter Agnefjäll.
I think we'll halve the installed cost over the next 10 years of solar. So it's great sense to do it today. It will be unthinkable not to do it in 10 years' time.
Could he be wrong? Perhaps more money will pick wind energy. And in certain places, it's cheaper, says Michael Liebreich of Bloomberg New Energy Finance. He spoke in a noisy UN hallway.
So if you look at the Great Plains in the US, you look at Brazil, you look at Australia, you look at India, you look at China. If you want really cheap electrical power, you build a wind farm now.
Now, on the other hand,
you've got some very expensive technologies people would like to believe are part of the solution. Offshore wind is being done, but it's expensive. But then you can go up to wave power, and then always, you know, on transportation, fuel cells. You know.
Of course, down the road, fuel cells make it cheaper. But the point is that customers and investors have no interest in overpaying. With a carbon price, the low-cost, low CO2 products win. An efficient, shall we say, cheapskate road to a low-carbon future. In New York, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Nothing cheapskate at all on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, here's the geopolitical through line of the week that I made a nod to earlier. President Obama addressed the United Nations General Assembly today, talking ISIS. He called it a network of death. And as you know, as part of the effort to dismantle that network, the United States turned to a trusted weapon this week, launching at least 47 Tomahawk cruise missiles at targets in Syria. That is, Kate Davidson reports, good news for a weapon on the budgetary chopping block.
By best estimates, the U.S. has about 4,000 Tomahawk missiles, or did until this week. Todd Harrison with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments says one way Tomahawks are launched is from ships.
It has wings that fold out and a jet engine that turns on, and it powers it like an airplane.
Raytheon makes the Tomahawks, which cost the military more than $1 million each.
We had been buying them at a rate of almost 200 per year.
But the Department of Defense wants to find a replacement and phase out purchases.
And in 2015, they're planning to cut that in half to only 100. And in 2016 and beyond, they had zeroed out that budget line, indicating they don't plan to buy any more Tomahawk cruise missiles.
Mackenzie Eaglin is a defense and military analyst at the American Enterprise Institute. She says some in Congress had already wanted to extend the Tomahawk program. She says this campaign against ISIS could convince more lawmakers that's necessary.
The caveat for ending the program next year by the Navy was always that there would be no unanticipated events that could drain current stockpiles of Tomahawks before a new missile is ready.
So all this could be good news for Raytheon, says Gordon Adams, a professor of international relations at American University.
For any contractor that is making ammunition or building a piece of equipment that's being used in the campaign against ISIS, the campaign against ISIS is good news about the near-term future for that program.
And for the company behind it. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
We were telling you yesterday about Walmart starting up medical clinics in some of its stores. Low-cost primary care as a revenue source is the business model there. Today, it's low-cost checking accounts. The country's biggest retailer says it's going to offer low-cost checking to anybody 18 and older. Walmart is partnering with Green Dot, the folks best known for prepaid debit cards. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports they are going after the unbanked in this country, which, according to the FDIC, may now be one in four Americans.
The new mobile checking account is called GoBank. No overdraft fees, no bounce check fees, no minimum balance requirement. That's a tempting offer to low-income consumers who get dinged when they have a bad month. Morningstar banking analyst Dan Werner.
If you're below a certain balance, generally you'll probably get charged from $12 to $15 or $20 per month just on your account. In terms of overdraft fees, it's usually about $35 to $50, depending upon the bank.
Walmart says its customers want an alternative to all those fees. Many of them have never had a deposit account and rely on check cashing firms and payday loans. The retailer has tried to obtain a banking license in the past, but regulators have rejected the idea. Mike Mebs, CEO of economic research firm Mebs Services, says by partnering with a bank like Green Dot, they can still get a slice of that business. He calls it shadow banking.
Walmart has already done this with check cashing and with money orders and with money transfers. And they've done it very, very successfully.
Mebs expects Walmart to get a cut of the so-called swipe fee every time a customer uses GoBank's debit card. Walmart today wouldn't comment on its financial relationship with Green Dot. It does say it'll be quick to sign up for an account. Walmart's Daniel Eckert says customers can literally sign up with a smartphone app in the parking lot. Apparently that always low prices thing is now also always fast banking. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The modern classroom is packed with digital technology. In a lot of schools, kids take school laptops home to do their assignments at night. Their academic progress is tracked at every test and quiz. And all of that data is changing things. It's changing the business of teaching, the dynamics of being a student, and it's changing how to be a parent. Parents are being asked to do more to keep up and keep tabs. From Learning Curve, our project on education and technology, Marketplace's Adrian Hill has that story.
On a recent evening at High Tech Los Angeles, a charter high school in Van Nuys, California, parents were the dutiful students. They were learning how to log in to see their kids' grades, to check on their homework assignments, their absences, and late arrivals. One of the parents' scribbling notes was Nune Karajan, who has two sons at the high school.
My parents just looked at the report card when it came home, and they said, good job, let's go out for dinner.
Not anymore. At schools around the country, parents have a new part-time job, watchdog. They have access to all sorts of academic information. So it's on them now to know if their kids go off track by flubbing a test or missing a homework assignment. Matt McClinahan is a teacher at High Tech Los Angeles. He says the school needs parents as allies.
What we're trying to do is develop learners who have the right habits to be successful in college and to be successful in the workplace. And that means to be on top of the workflow.
McClinahan says he's not trying to turn parents into surveillance machines.
The parents often feel like they have to be on top of everything that's going on. We'll have parents who check their child's grades several times a day.
The hyper-focus on grades and scores worries Alfie Cohn. He's written many parenting and education books.
Parents are often asked to become the enforcer of the school's agenda.
He says we're not measuring or tracking the most important things.
So the more schools are encouraging parents to think about grades and tests and homework assignments, the more danger there is that meaningful learning will be eclipsed.
I asked some parents at High Tech Los Angeles what it's like to have the responsibility, or at least ability, to check on every grade, every homework assignment.
Oh, Lord.
That's parent Kathy Gadagne. She has a freshman at the high school.
So I have to keep an eye on their kids much more so over the internet instead of just nagging them for their homework.
Parent Nune Karajan, the one whose parents used to take her out for dinner after a good report card, she says her kids have asked her to trust them enough not to check their grades all the time. But she understands the lure of micromanaging a child's education today.
Now I think it's a lot more competitive and there's a lot more at stake.
And trust or not, she's not going to give up on all of her digital oversight. She's still going to log into the school's college application program to make sure her older son gets all his paperwork in on time. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
All right, so come on, fess up. How closely do you track your kids' grades online? You can tell us. We won't tell anybody. Marketplace.org/learningcurve. Coming up.
We go into it knowing what's working on the service. And so you have a few genres in your mind that you're kind of looking for.
Big data and the future of TV. But first, let's do the numbers. Ooh, the happy music. Been a while since we've heard that. The Dow Industrials rebounded 0.9% today, 154 points, 17,210 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ bounced back 1%, 46 points, 45.55. The S&P 500 regained 0.75%, 15 points, finished at 1998. Today's bounce came courtesy of the Chicago Fed president, who said the central bank should be, quote, exceptionally patient in raising interest rates. Good data on housing help as well. Goldman Sachs up 1.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase picked up more than 1%. Bed Bath & Beyond bubbled up more than 7% today after reporting better-than-expected revenues. The Walmart Green Dot deal to offer checking accounts that we told you about sent both stocks to the Bank, get it? Bank. Walmart up 2%, Green Dot, Dot deposited a whopping 24%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Commerce Department reports on durable goods for August. That's stuff like appliances, computers, and cars. But let's not get greedy. Or shall we? Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. The actor behind the fictional Wall Street tycoon Gordon Gekko has a birthday. Michael Douglas turns 70. And on September 25th, 1981, Sandra Day O'Connor became the first woman to serve as a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you're a label reader on clothes or accessories, you know location counts. So when you see Made in Italy, you know you're probably going to pay a little bit extra for whatever it is that you're buying. Country of origin is a powerful element of a lot of upscale brands. Think Ferrari or Prada. Italians, in fact, consider the label a national economic resource. But as Sam Harnett reminds us, it is best not to believe everything you read.
If a handbag is stamped Made in Italy, it may seem safe to assume that it is, well, entirely made in Italy. Patricia Jerwitz says, think again.
Well, there's no guarantee that it's being handcrafted at a small workshop up in the Alps.
Jerwitz is the director of the Responsible Sourcing Network. Her organization advocates for more transparency in supply chains.
It's extremely difficult to really understand what companies are doing and how they're having their products manufactured.
In the U.S., there are laws. A product's last substantial transformation must happen in the country of origin. Guillermo Jimenez of the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York explains.
So if you have the handle of the handbag come from South America and the leather panels come from India and another part comes from another country, well, none of that is a handbag yet.
But put all those pieces together in Italy and presto, Italian handbag, right?
That's legally allowable, but arguably can be deceptive to the consumer.
Well, it's definitely profitable for companies. That claim helps them charge top dollar. But the only way to know for sure how a bag is made is to visit the company factories. Jimenez says U.S. Customs and the Federal Trade Commission don't have the resources to keep tabs on all of them.
With the dizzying number of handbag manufacturers in the world, it's hard for the FTC to stay on top of it.
In fact, the Trade Commission hasn't brought a case against a fashion company for violating country of origin laws in over a decade. Many Italians, however, would like a stricter definition for made in Italy.
Il 100% made in Italy ha oggi una garanzia.
This is what you hear when you're put on hold at madeinitaly.org in Milan. The initiative is funded by the Italian government to provide an additional label for products completely manufactured in the country. Now, we're talking everything. Components, design, the works. Marco Tomasini is with madeinitaly.org.
If you want to buy a real Italian product, then, you know, it's easier if you actually have a certification that proves that. It's just to be very clear about what you're actually offering to the end user.
Tomasini says this certification helps smaller Italian manufacturers stand out from global brands with sophisticated supply chains. It reassures customers that the products are made entirely in Italy. Keenan Dufty is a designer and professor at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco. He wonders if customers today really care.
The younger consumer, I'm not sure if they are as concerned about where the goods are made. I think they're more concerned about the label.
Dufty says it's less about what the label actually means and more about what it signifies. Status and luxury.
With luxury anything, you're buying a fantasy.
Here's some fantasy for you. This woman is showing off her new handbag on YouTube.
I am so excited to share with you my new purchase and the unboxing of it as well.
One of the big moments in her video is when she displays the label. And whether it's entirely true or just partly true, the Made in Italy stamp makes owners like her proud.
It's got the Made in Italy by Gucci stamp on the outside of it.
The handbag is a Gucci Swing leather tote. It retails online for over $1,000. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
We're going to pick up with our series on the future of TV. Who's doing it right now, and what is yet to come? We're calling it Screen Wars.
Television.
No money down.
That one's in the dirt.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
This is a big week for the broadcast network. Season premieres for a lot of shows. On Friday, though, a new series from Amazon Studios, Transparent, is going to have a premiere of its own. All the episodes will be available to Amazon Prime customers all at once. The old binge-watching business model, sort of a la Orange is the New Black or House of Cards. At this point, you might reasonably stop and ask, how did an online retailer end up making television shows? And, you know, why? Roy Price is the guy with the answers. He runs Amazon Studios. Roy, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Kai. It's great to be here.
So when you go to a dinner party or you're at the kids' soccer game or you're hanging out at the beach and people say, what do you do? What do you tell them?
I run Amazon Studios. We develop TV shows for Amazon.com. That's usually what I tell them, unless I'm in a kidding mood.
An expensive mood,
perhaps. Yeah.
Why is Amazon doing this? I mean, they've got a pretty good gig doing a whole bunch of other stuff.
Everyone wants to feel special and different.
We do.
And, and Amazon Prime is no exception. And the essential point is to make Amazon Prime even more fabulous and fantastic. So in addition to the shipping, we have a video service. And as part of the video service, we have these original shows that are developed just for Prime customers.
Talk to me for a second about the process, about how you, as the guy running the show, picks the pilots, what happens once you decide something's okay, and where it goes from there.
You know, we get a lot of stuff in from writers, producers, these ideas and scripts. And
people just come in pitching you.
Oh, sure. But of course, we go into it knowing what's working on the service, knowing what is working as part of Amazon Prime. And so, you know, so you have a few genres in your mind that you're kind of looking for.
When you say you know what is working, the buzzword of the day is big data. I mean, you know what we're clicking on, what we're fast forwarding through, all that stuff.
Yeah. So we know what's driving, right, you know, success and engagement on Prime. And so you can look at something like Downton Abbey or The Good Wife or other shows, and you know those are resonating. At the same time, though, one of the riskiest paths in entertainment is to be derivative and to try to do the same thing. That is like a path to failure. So you can't say, you know, oh, Downton Abbey was successful, so we're going to do like another, what's the house next door to Downton Abbey?
Right,
and we're going to do that.
Right.
You know, that doesn't work. So you got to get kind of the spirit of it and try to find things that you think capture that.
You, Amazon Studios, would seem to be in a pretty stable space right now, just in terms of your business model, right? You got $99 a whack coming from a whole bunch of people who buy Amazon Prime, which, full disclosure, I do.
Excellent.
The catch, of course, is that with that model, you have to give people what they want. What happens if you sort of lose your mojo, man?
In original content?
Yeah.
Well, we would certainly quickly be able to perceive that. And
because you know what we're clicking on. You know,
yeah,
what we're
we'll
watching.
See. Like, right, this show's not working. And then someone on the team would be severely punished. you know, look, you're never going to bat 1,000. In TV or movies, and you gotta be.
What do you have to bet? I can bet 330 in the major leagues and get to the Hall of Fame. What do you have
That's
to bet
right.
in television?
I don't know. You know, I used to have a boss at Disney who said, "All I have to do is be right more than half the time."
The easy answer to this next question is, you know, Netflix and other streaming services. So I want a different answer. Who's your competition?
You know, on the one hand, you could say, you know, any source of entertainment, you know, or you could go more narrow and talk about TV channels and stuff. Personally, you know, I think the TV business now is so diverse and there are so many players and so on that it doesn't make sense or it doesn't really help you make decisions if you're spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, what folks down the road are developing or what they're up to. Like, I just don't know. Like, if I sat around here all morning and thought about how, you know, I don't know, Netflix has this and that show, I don't know what I would then do.
What do you suppose television is going to be like in 25 years?
My prediction is that everything or anything that you may find inconvenient or annoying about TV now is going to be innovated away. I anticipate a lot of improvements in terms of navigation. Right now, I just moved to LA 10 days ago, so I'm staying with a friend, and he doesn't have the optimal AV setup, so I have to like scroll through his insane pay TV box. I'm like literally scrolling through, like, oh, this channel 572, and I think we can do better. Right? And I think the whole idea of, even with the exception of sports or live events, even the concept of like coming into a show in the middle of the show, I think may soon be like part of the past. Like, I don't know why that is a helpful thing for me. It's not.
So when I sit down, the show I want ought to be starting right then.
It should start when you start. You should be the boss.
Amen,
you
bro.
Know? Yeah, not the schedule. So I think that, and then just having some idea of what you might want to watch, you know, and giving you some options that are a little more logical, not just random or a random list.
Roy Price, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Tell you what, take a minute, tweet us your thoughts about the future of TV. And while you're at it, what shows do you like to live tweet and watch at the same time? You can get the show, this one, that is, at Marketplace on Twitter. You can get me at Kai Rizdahl.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the Pew Research Center, the number of Americans who've always been single and plan never to marry is at an all-time high. Here's the slice of that data that makes it a marketplace thing. Pew says having a job is an important feature in a future husband. So here you go. 50 years ago, there were 139 single young men with jobs for every 100 single young women. Now, 91 single young men with jobs for every 100 single women. Times do change. All right, we're done. That is the show for today. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shea Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.